Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're going to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com. And now you can download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
I'm pretty well as well. I have was working late last night trying to fit everybody in for Valentine's Day weekend. Holy camoli. You know, it's very interesting when you look at Valentine's Day because it really does, it puts a lot of strain on a restaurant. And I think it's a strain that can certainly be handled in a good way. But what's interesting, people may not realize that there's a different feeling on Valentine's Day and the Saturday before because everything's a deuce.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the polyamorous couples or triples or whatever. No, but I mean, it's what I think a lot of people don't realize is that one of the things and one of the reasons that restaurants go for tasting menus, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday on Valentine's Day, is when you do 150 dinners on any other night of the week, that's usually 50 or 45 mm-hmm. tickets and tables.
Right, it's fours and sixes and eights. And
when you do 150 dinners on Valentine's Day?
75 tickets.
That's exactly what that is, 75 tickets.
So, Francis.
Yeah.
Did you read, and I know we've talked about this on a prior show, but this week's New York Times, there was an article on Teflon.
Yes, I did, and
did
it pissed
did it,
me off.
Did it make you mad?
It pissed me off.
Why would it make you mad?
Just hey, wait, I have it, actually. It's in the packet that you handed me.
Okay.
Here we are. This is by Marion Burroughs. Now, we did a show on Teflon where we talked about Teflon for
about 6 months
About 6 months ago. So we scooped the times once again. but there's a lot of trouble.
All apologies to Marion Burroughs.
There's a lot of trouble with Teflon. And let me read you a little from this article from February 8th in the Times. As Teflon, the headline of the article, as Teflon troubles pile up, DuPont, the manufacturer, responds with ads.
That's how you have to respond, right? Let's see. You're serving poison. Better advertise.
Better advertise. Don't worry about it. Everything's fine. Okay. The chemical used to make Teflon, as well as grease-resistant packaging and stain-resistant textiles, has been the subject of a lot of bad news recently. In December, that's in December of 2005, the Environmental Protection Agency reached a $16.5 million settlement with DuPont over the company's failure to report health risks from chemical perfluorotannic acid, also known as PFOA. That's in, among other things, Teflon.
Okay, I'm just going to call it PFOA, if that's all right
now,
with you.
Now, let's get this back in. The EPA was paid $16.5 million from DuPont because DuPont didn't report the health risks in Teflon. So what I ask you then is, do we think that DuPont is a trustworthy company? They're going to just tell us anything that's wrong and say, oh, my God, this might be dangerous.
Trustworthy company. You've already paid a lawsuit where it
that's
says.
What I'm saying. What I'm saying is they're going to lie like scumbags as long as they can get away with it. That's what I'm saying. Okay, yep. Now check this out. A few days later, a majority of the EPA's scientific review panel advised the agency that the chemical should be classified as a likely carcinogen. What that means is that there's evidence that it causes cancer in animals, and the evidence that it causes cancer in humans is suggestive enough for me not to feed it to my baby.
They haven't done enough studies on it yet, is what that means.
So now we have the EPA coming out and saying, hey, wait a second, this thing is causes problem. It can cause cancer. Now, the agency announced that it reached an agreement with eight companies, including DuPont, to eliminate PFOAs and chemicals that break down into PFOA from all consumer products from 2015. Okay, so it's bad. You didn't tell everybody it's bad, so you had to pay $16 million, and you've promised to pull it off the market by 2015, so you probably realize it's bad.
What? But why do we have to have it for 9 more years?
The recent negative
from
the...
It's really bad. It's poison. You told me it's poison.
Not only do we have to have it for nine more years...
I have to have it for 9 more years.
Not only do we have to have it for 9 more years, but the recent negative publicity prompted DuPont, which manufactures Teflon nonstick cookware, to run full-page advertisement last week in newspapers, including the Times, telling the public that cookware coated with Teflon is safe, and there's no reason to stop using it, except, of course, they're going to stop using
it
in 2016.
In 2016 is when it becomes poison. It's not poison from now till then.
And DuPont assures you that it's totally safe. Of course, DuPont just paid $16.5 million for lying to the EPA about what was safe and what wasn't, so I really trust them. Here's the deal. An overheated empty Teflon... The Environmental Working Group, which is a nonprofit environmental research organization, agrees that Teflon-coated pans are not a major source of PFOA, okay? They're not a major source, but they need to be used with care. In addition to that, an overheated empty Teflon-coated pan poses some risk because it releases toxic gases, which are especially dangerous for, say, birds. DuPont says this is only likely to happen. DuPont, which just paid $16.5 million for lying, says that happens at 660 degrees, while the other scientists, who have not had to pay any fine for lying, say it happens at 325 degrees.
So it's dangerous for birds. Does that mean we shouldn't cook chicken in it?
I'm going to share with you an old coal miner trick.
I'm sorry, one more time. They say it's dangerous for birds, so does that mean we shouldn't cook chicken in it?
I didn't get that. I'm so on my high horse, I didn't even hear that. That's funny. No, all pans are dangerous for birds in that way. So what happens is if you've got your canary in your kitchen and your Teflon pan goes over 660 degrees...
And this is a real thing. We talked about this in the show. Bird owners have to be careful using their Teflon products because you can actually kill your canary or your parakeet... If it's in your kitchen while you're using Teflon pans.
Right, and DuPont says this is only likely to happen if it goes over 660 degrees, which means you left the empty pan on the stove and walked away and forgot about it, and now your parakeet's dead. But the scientists who have not had to pay a recent fine for lying say that 325 degrees is when it starts to release these harmful gases. Now, I'm going to share with you an old coal miner trick about canaries. When the birds die, get out.
Get out as fast as you can.
Run.
Exactly.
You know, and so what they say is it's funny that people have said in the past, well, you should definitely not have your birds in the kitchen if you cook with Teflon. Okay, let me tell you something. Leave the birds in the kitchen. Don't cook with Teflon.
Take your four-year-old out, okay? That's...
Okay, the other thing that you all need to be careful about, and this appears in the Times article as well, is fluorotelomers, chemicals used in packaging, can also break down into PFOA, but there's currently no way for consumers to tell if a package contains the chemicals because there's no labeling requirement. The FDA has found that PFOA migrates from the oil to the oil in the food from the packaging, especially in microwave bags where you heat stuff up.
Yeah, microwave popcorn is a big... transmitter of this.
The safe level for PFOA, which is found in the blood of 95% of Americans, I don't know if that scares anybody,
is unknown.
We don't know. We don't know until 2015, because now that it's a likely carcinogen that we have to, by law, do a full health study, but that won't be out until 2015. But if you're using the microwavable popcorn, why not be safe? Take it out of the bag, stick it in a paper bag, okay? And you can put one staple. You know you're not supposed to put metal in your microwave, but one staple won't do anything bad. And you take the paper bag, you put the popcorn in the paper bag, you can throw a little oil in there if you want, and just one staple to close the bag shut, and do it that way. Don't heat your popcorn in the bag that it comes in.
You know, it's funny because we were opening the new restaurant, and Chef wanted to buy a couple of nonstick pans for the new restaurant about a year ago, and I handed him all the articles and things on Teflon that I had been researching. He's like, "We're not buying those."
Yeah. Well, they're convenient, but again, it's just if it's gonna kill a bird at 350 or 625. Why can't we use something else? Stainless steel works really great. I'm all into that.
I'm all for using something else.
Anyway, so again, that's the story from DuPont, which just paid a $16.5 million settlement over its failure to report health risks. Well, there you go. That's how much I trust them. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Daniel Young. He was once the restaurant critic for the New York Daily News. His articles have appeared in publications like Gourmet, Bon Appetit, and the New York Times. He's author of several books, including Made in Marseille, The Rough Guide to New York City Restaurants, and the Paris Café Cookbook. He's just published a new book, The Bistros, Brasseries, and Wine Bars of Paris, and we're fortunate enough to have him join us today. Hi, Daniel.
Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Francis.
You know, okay, your book, we read your book, and we love it, and so we asked you to come on the show.
Thank you.
Brasseries, bistros, wine bars, what's the difference?
Well, good question, and if I spent 2.5 years in Paris just asking that question to everybody I met.
Uh-huh.
And what kinds of answers did you get?
Very interesting ones, none of them true.
Okay.
Even hairdressers were no good in that regard. The problem is the terms have changed so much over the years. and also they've come to stand for the same thing.
So what did they once mean? What were the differences at one time?
Okay, bistro originally was more of a wine bar. It was a counter where they served wines for working men or migrant workers. People went in for a glass of wine. Somebody got the brilliant idea of serving a pas du jour, a special, to wash down the wine. It was more the food washing down the wine than the reverse.
Uh-huh. Like a charcuterie or something like that?
Meat plate? Not quite. Mm-hmm. More just like a stew.
Okay.
Very rough and tumble. Middle class people wouldn't be seen in a bistro. Very working class, dirty, very few women. It really was a wine bar which happened to have food.
Uh-huh.
Brasseries, on the other hand, the word brasserie in French means brewery.
Right.
So brasseries were really beer halls.
Mm-hmm.
And so they added food, like you mentioned before, charcuterie, but choucroute, sausage, and sauerkraut, which is the classic beer dish.
Mm-hmm.
It was they were opened, the brasseries, by people from the eastern French region of Alsace, very near the German border.
Right.
So they loved beer. So they came into Paris, opened these beer halls, and decided to serve food with it. So bistro was wine, brasserie was beer, first and foremost, and each of them had food almost as an afterthought.
And the cafes?
And cafes were more genteel. They were places where people went for a beverage, people in suits and hats and dresses and so forth. It was more of a classy atmosphere.
And how did that wind up differing from a full-on restaurant?
Well, eventually, bistros became more and more restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And brasseries in the after the First World War became these grand cafe restaurants where champagne was more the drink than beer. So those became the places to see and be seen great people watching Mecca.
Now, at the time, the cafes were very social places to be. Were the bistros and brasseries the same way?
They were very social, and that's another reason why there's confusion, because basically conviviality, warmth, comfort, easygoing is something that they have in common. I like to say it's sort of, my book is sort of the Tuesday night dinner, Tuesday night out in Paris cookbook. It's not about Saturday night dinners. It's about routine dinners with friends in the neighborhood. It just so happens that Paris is probably the best place on the planet. Not on a Tuesday night.
I'm with you there.
You actually write that in your book, and I thought that was a great thing to say. You say that Paris is probably the best place in the world to go out to dinner on a Tuesday night because it's part of a normal functioning, you know, part of the everyday food. You know, the French take it pretty darn seriously.
Exactly. It's true that on the three-star level, four-star level, the rest of the world is caught up.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find great restaurants in major metropolitan centers throughout the U.S. Even London has great three- and four-star restaurants, and we know British food always had a bad reputation. But
mm-hmm.
where the world hasn't caught up is on this Tuesday night bistro thing. Bistros in the U.S., there's sort of corruptions of the term.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody like Daniel Ballou or Alan Ducasse, they decide that, or Thomas Keller, they decide, let's open a little restaurant on the side, smaller, charge less, turntables more, and we'll call it a bistro, because bistro takes the edge off French cuisine. We think of French as a little bit snooty, but mm-hmm. bistro sounds warm, which it is. But it lacks the soul of a real bistro, the place I was telling you about when we started, the place where cab drivers or students
mm-hmm.
Could feel comfortable and eat great food.
I think, unfortunately, in this country, one of the things that we've gone to is where the French use these bistros and brasseries and wine bars, we use places like Applebee's and Bennigan's and Houlihan's. And I think that's to our detriment.
But you can never get a center of community, a local locus of community at a chain restaurant. It's incongruous. And I think that what you're saying about brasseries and bistros is more like the position that the Irish bar, the local bar, holds in Irish culture as a center of community. Is that what you're saying?
Bingo, right on. I would say the closest counterpart to the original bistros would be kind of the Greek diners.
Uh-huh.
Before they became these palatial restaurants that we know where they have, you know, 15-page laminated menus. But the blue plate special sort of diners, you know, a counter and some tables, some booths.
And
booths are the banquettes. the diner.
And what the French have always done better than Americans is, it, if you really want to loosen up a diner, if you serve a little wine there, it will be much better. That's kind of funny. Our guest is Daniel Young. His book, or his most recent book, is called The Bistros, Brasseries, and Wine Bars of Paris, which is a book about those places and also a collection of recipes from those places. And when we come back, we're going to talk with him about how exactly he was able to wrestle recipes from some of the best chefs of these places in Paris and about the position that these places hold in French culture overall. It's a fascinating book. We're going to link you to it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, so you can go pick it up. And we'll be talking more with Daniel Young in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25. You know, Mark and I are always saying that long-term, good environmental policy and good economic policy are one and the same. And that's not just for the government, it's also for small business and homeowners just like you. To help us put our money where our mouth is, we called E2ECTA. E2ECTA uses a team of specialists to find practical ways for your business or home to conserve energy and even to generate green energy that the utility company then has to buy back from you. That generates a different kind of green for your bottom line. We've gone solar at our restaurants. We're now producing cheap, non-polluting electricity, and with the help of E2ECTA, we did it for very little money. The government programs available to get you set up are unbelievable. We're talking about grants here, not loans, but grants. E2ECTA will help you find the right programs for you, and they'll do the paperwork. You keep the profits. It's a no-brainer, people. For lower energy usage, more profits for yourself, call E2ECTA at 908-359-9300 or click on their link at restaurantguysradio.com. E2ECTA for total energy solutions. Our guest is Daniel Young. He was once a restaurant critic for New York Daily News. His articles have appeared, freelance articles have appeared in all the best publications about food. And his most recent book is The Bistros, Brasseries, and Wine Bars of Paris. Now, the book that you've written, it's really fascinating in that it's a history of the of these types of restaurants and French restaurant culture and sort of a culture that many cultures have tried to sort of copy. And it also deals in recipes. And we'll talk about the cookbook aspect of your book a little bit later. But you go back about the history of where these restaurants came from. I love one of the references. You talk about, you mentioned that in A Tale of Two Cities, a lot of the action happens at the Defarge Wine Shop, you know, in Dickens' time.
Right.
And you say that that's almost recognizable as a currently is a wine bar.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. The same kind of, you know, very nosy managers or people running it, checking out newcomers when they come in. And
I've, are you there?
I'm sorry. You know, they're checking out newcomers. They're very suspicious. They're sharing wines with some people and not with others. You know, it's just, it's a real rustic old French environment. But that is a wine bar.
Mm-hmm.
Wine bars are kind of doing what bistros used to do.
Mm-hmm.
So they
used to be wine counters. Now they're restaurants, mainly lunch and dinner, and closed during the day, so the wine bars are taking their place. But this exists really for 2,000 years. There were taverns in Julius Caesar's day when he was in France.
Mm-hmm. I remember when I was in high school, I read a lot of the expatriate writers of the 30s and 40s, and I would read about either in their fiction or about them, and I would hear about these places where they would hang out, like La Coupole and Brasserie Lip. And I remember when I was 25, I went to Paris, and I'm really a food-driven kind of guy. I went to Europe to visit wineries and to go to, like, La Coupole and Brasserie mm-hmm. Lip. It's amazing these institutions have been there for so long.
Forever.
And occupy a part of the culture.
The great thing about those brasseries, they really are, there are many great things, but they're really about noise and people watching and a show. It's really a piece of theater. We think of great service as service you barely can see or know that's there. At a brasserie, it's just the opposite. Great brasserie service, it's a continuous show. But you watch these guys working the floor, and it's great theater.
But one of the things that they do in Paris that we don't do here, in those types of places, the food has become very important.
Well, and also, I mean, you know, we have this image of the snooty French waiter, and there's nothing that's further from the truth in these places. It's a little difficult, and there's its own lexicon. We're talking about the bistros, brasseries, and wine bars of Paris with the author of a book by that name, Daniel Young, and we'll be talking more with him after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kaplan Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today our guest is Daniel Young. He was once the restaurant critic of the New York Daily News. His articles have appeared in publications like Gourmet and Bon Appetit and the New York Times. He's the author of several books, including Made in Marseille, The Rough Guide to New York City Restaurants, and the Paris Cafe Cookbook. His most recent book is The Bistros, Brasseries, and Wine Bars of Paris, which is both a book about those places and a cookbook of recipes from those places. And we're fortunate enough to have him join us by telephone today. Daniel, we were talking before the break about these restaurants that they're almost like national treasures. They have a historic place in history and in the history of France. And when you go visit Paris, you can go to, I'm thinking of a place called La Coupole that I visited when I was 25. And it's this monstrous, huge place where that serves great food, and there are all these service people on the floor. And, you know, when you go to a fine dining restaurant, the service is supposed to be understated and stealth. And in these places, the service is very in your face, and it's very friendly. And it is a show. I'm thinking of...
It's more neighborhoody.
But I'm thinking of La Coupole, which is this grand brasserie. And when it's this huge place, one of the hugest restaurants I've ever been in. So there must be 25 waiters on the floor or more. And whenever it's your birthday, they come out with a cake and like a Roman candle, you know. And it's like there's like 35-foot ceilings, and the waiters all come, like 25 of them, and sing you happy birthday in French. And it's always been my dream to go there on my birthday.
It is unbelievable. They break out in happy birthday about 3-4 times per night.
Yeah, I know. And they turn off all the lights. I mean, there got to be 350 people sat in this restaurant. They turn off all the lights and walk with a Roman candle. But isn't that indicative of what the service is like at these places? Very in your face and friendly.
It is a professional service. One thing that Americans don't understand often, and it's not their fault, they're not fluent in French, and sometimes the waiters are not fluent in English, is the waiters love to rib you. They love to tease you, play with you. There's a back and forth. And sometimes Americans think they're being made fun of or mocked when it's just the opposite.
Yeah.
They mock the Parisians. They mock the regulars most.
But
they love to joke around.
It's kind of like your neighborhood bartender here in the United States, where you have that kind of relationship where it's a back and forth.
But I also think that, you know, Paris is a bit of a cynical city, like New York is a bit of a cynical city. But, it, you know, it's an appreciation of satire, you know. And I think that there is, you know, even when I was in Paris, I remember the first time I went to Paris, I was like 25, 24 years old. And we met some Americans in the train station. And they were like, we're getting out of the city, these people are so rude. And I thought... I had a great time. I didn't... My experience at the bars, brasseries, and bistros in Paris, and, you know, I'm an eater, right? And I was poor. You know, I wasn't spending a lot of money. Now I spend a lot of money on food.
Mm-hmm.
But my experience was that it was the exact opposite of the stereotype of the snooty French waiter. Did you encounter the snooty French waiter today?
No, but I'm going to the best places, and good restaurants do a lot of things well, and it's just one of them. So they're possibly tourist traps.
Yeah, that's...
bad restaurants where you have that. One thing I would recommend to listeners is always to reserve wherever you're going to dine in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
One, because you're short of a table, but even more importantly, you're making a conscious decision you want to dine at this restaurant.
Right.
And they appreciate that. It's sort of a respect to the chef and the place that you've called, particularly if you called from the States, that you've called ahead. That makes a huge difference in terms of the table you get and the quality of service. You'll get good service wherever you are, depending on the restaurant, but you'll be treated just a little bit better by having reserved in advance, and you know your table's there.
I also think some of the things that Americans don't do when we go abroad, and I've had the good fortune of an aunt who lives just outside of Paris, so I get to go fairly frequently and for most of my life. A couple things are, A, just what you said, avoid those tourist traps. They're places where you will find more temperamental and snooty types of people, but just like you would here in the United States, find those types of people, I think. And the other thing that I find can make a big difference as well is, even before I spoke French, learn a couple of phrases, learn a couple of questions. Even if the question is, I don't speak French very well, can you help me? Is there anybody here who can help me? Those types of overtures, I think, go a long, long way.
I agree totally. On the other hand, if you don't have that ability, I really wouldn't worry. Friends I hear from have great experiences, particularly at the better bistros.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I will tell you there's one thing that you should avoid that I actually have seen, and I don't know where it comes about. If you don't speak French and you're speaking to a waiter who doesn't speak English, speaking louder is not going to help. It's just you're just yelling at the man. That's all that's going on.
Two other points of advice,
please.
If I may.
Yeah.
At bistros, you order the specials without fail.
Mm-hmm.
The bistros are market-driven cuisine, not NASDAQ market, based on what they find that morning. And it's a little bit different than in the States, where specials might be more expensive or highlighting luxurious ingredients. At bistros, they're literally bargains, blue plate specials.
Yep.
It's what the chef is inspired most by that particular day, and it's the best deal and the freshest food. On brasseries, on the other hand, the specials are not good. Brasseries specialize in doing the classics.
Mm-hmm.
And the chef, they will try to bump up the check with a special if they find lobster or whatever. But it's the chefs are generals. They're at the pass, calling out orders. They're not touching a piece of food all day. So there's going to be some line cook who's overworked trying to get the 50th big treat out. You shouldn't get the fussy dishes at a brasserie. It's the exact opposite.
So let's go back and help us some more to figure out what today's bistros are as compared to today's brasseries. How do we know, unless it's called Brasserie Lip, that it's a brasserie?
Well, one of the big differences is bistros serve only at lunch and dinner, generally, whereas brasseries are continuous service.
Mm-hmm.
Brasseries will have more fancy white linen. Bistros will kind of have that red checkered cloth or simple napkins, things like that. And brasserie waiters will be uniformed without fail, black and white. They're like penguins.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas bistros will never have that kind of garb.
Well, now, all right. Now, I only have a couple of minutes left in this segment, but and again, our guest is Daniel Young, and his book that we're talking about is The Bistros, Brasseries, and Wine Bars of Paris. One of the things that you talk about in your book is you talk about how some of the independent brasseries and bistros are being gobbled up by both small restaurant groups and then even by large chains. How is that affecting the situation of the culture of those places in the culture of French cuisine?
Well, there's not that big an influence in terms of chains on the bistro. There are a couple of bistro chains, but they're like Bennigan's things. They're not in the book. They're not taking up good properties. It's really not a factor. They're connected to chain hotels. What's happening, though, is several of the bistros are being gobbled up by groups. And unfortunately, it's an economic necessity. It's very hard in these times to run a bistro, a brasserie that has 200 covers without kind of the power of centralizing your ordering and accounting and so forth. So on the one hand, the chains, there are two chains in particular. One's called Flo. The other one is called Bertrand. But Flo gobbles up bistros like La Coupole, and the good part is they save them.
I'm sorry, you mean brasseries.
Brasseries. God, I keep doing that. Sorry about that. They gobble up the brasseries, and they kind of save them. These are landmarks that would go under were not for a group with the aggressive marketing and so forth.
So you feel good about these changes? You think they're doing
part.
The right thing?
The bad part is that there's a sameness to it. You find if it's lobster special at Beaufinger, it's going to be lobster special at La Coupole.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, avoid it. So they, from a menu point of view, they lose what makes them
the individual.
Unique.
Yeah.
And it is a loss. On the other hand, you know, I thank Flo for saving these places, but wish they could maintain their individuality more.
So what you're saying is better that they're still there, but better that they were there as more individual.
Right.
Well,
definitely,
I think
there has been some opposition, and people have raised their voice about this, and it's resulted, for example, Balzar, the brasserie, was taken over by Flo, but the pressure was so great to keep it as good as it was that it's even better than it was.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, I guess
that happens a lot here with the chains. They take over someplace and make it better. Just kidding.
No. Who are you? What happened there? Our guest is Daniel Young. His book is The Bistros, Brasseries, and Wine Bars of Paris. And it's a very interesting book because it talks about these institutions, and basically we have them copied in many other cultures, but they're very central, and where they came from is very interesting about what they are. But it's also a cookbook. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about some of the types of dishes you'll find there and how Daniel got some of these chefs at these landmark places to give him recipes that it's a great book that's going to be dog-eared in my kitchen because there's some real classics that you can make, and they're actually not that difficult. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis from Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in New Jersey. Our guest today is Daniel Young. His book is The Bistros, Brasseries, and Wine Bars of Paris. It is both a book about those places and also a cookbook of recipes from those places. If you want to pick up the book, you can link to it through our website at restaurantguysradio.com. And Daniel's here to talk with us. We've been talking about where these restaurants have come from, but this book, it's a great cookbook. It's eminently cookable. I mean, I'm sure that this is going to wind up a dog-eared edition in my kitchen because these dishes are not, you know, there are dishes, like the Alain Ducasse cookbook. It's like you have to buy special equipment and your kitchen's
right,
a disaster
and
seven hours later.
And 7 days later, I've cooked one of the dishes.
Right, exactly. Whereas this is cookable. Now, what guided your choice of what dishes to include, what restaurants to include, and what do you hope that people are going to get out of cooking this kind of food?
Well, that's a lot of questions in there. I guess I basically went to my favorite places and also had spies and great sources and so forth. And I certainly visited three or four places for every establishment I included in the book.
Yeah, sounds like hell. You got no sympathy from us.
And then I tasted the food before I even introduced myself to the chef, tasted things, zeroed in on things on the menu so I could have a diversity in the in ultimately what came out in the book, so I'd have a little bit of meat and fish and vegetables and very short things, good hors d'oeuvres, a bit modern, a bit classic, just looking for diversity. So I would approach the chefs after on the second or third visit, so I was sort of already a known quantity, at least by face, and tell them what I was up to and ask if I could have some recipes.
How do they react?
Well, at the beginning it's very, very difficult, but once you have a few big yeses, then you just mention, oh, well, so-and-so's doing it, and then they want to be in the book.
Yeah, we got Charlie Trotter on the radio show early for the same reason at the beginning of our career. We got Trotter was on, and then we got everybody else on. So it was, I know exactly what you're talking about.
They call it reference accounts, I think, in business.
Exactly. Now there are dishes that you have in there. I just want to give people an idea of what kind of things we have out there. This is unapologetic old world food. Things like poached whole chicken with cream sauce. And everybody, we're talking about poaching the whole chicken in 2 quarts of cream.
Sounds pretty good to me.
No messing around here, everybody. This is not the low-fat cookbook. You know what I mean?
You took an extreme example. I also have a roast chicken with cauliflower and hazelnuts that has none of that.
But you also have pan-fried steaks with mustard cream sauce, too.
Come on. This is not the diet cookbook. This is the flavor cookbook. And do me a favor. If you can invite me over to dinner, can you do it on the night when you're doing the cream sauce chicken, not the other one? Because you know what? We spend our time, and you know, we talk about whole food a lot. We talk about eating whole foods a lot. And they've come out recently to say that skim milk may be of no benefit and may actually add to hardening of the arteries. We know now that margarine is no good for you. That's much worse for you than if you just had whole butter. And I think that when you cook whole foods like this and you have a good wholesome meal, and if you can have a couple of good wholesome meals in the course of a day, having your whole chicken with the cream sauce is great if you don't eat a bag of Doritos, and you're probably less likely to eat a bag of Doritos. I love this food, and I think it's very real and very wholesome.
I think when you, anytime you're using whole and real ingredients, you're going to be much better off. And it's an area where the French were miles and miles ahead of us for a long time.
And they're thinner than we are. A lot thinner than we are.
I remember I lived in Europe for about 4 months, and the time I was there, one of the things that I found was that in the United States we allowed over 400 preservatives at the time. In France, the number was 7.
Wild stuff.
And, so, you know, and it's just how we view food as opposed to how they view food.
Were there tricks that you found, or were there commonalities that you found in getting all these different recipes from these different chefs, Daniel?
Not really. Every situation is different. You know, flattery always works.
Well, I mean, were there tricks to the cuisine that you found, or things that you said, that's how they do it?
Absolutely. I mean, I certainly learned to make the best steak frites in the world thanks to one chef.
What makes those steak frites the best steak frites?
Okay, well, the frites is pretty standard in that you're blanching them at about 315 degrees and then finishing them off, frying them to get what I call an SPF effect, a beautiful bronze at about 375 degrees.
Uh-huh.
And using an oil with a high smoking point, mm-hmm. like peanut oil or rapeseed oil. But the key I found that really works is to use a cast iron pot rather than a deep fryer.
Mm-hmm.
So put only about 2 or 2.5 inches of oil in there, get it hot, clip a thermometer on there, and for some reason, you know, Russ Parsons of the Los Angeles Times did a wonderful book on the French fry. There's all kinds of alchemy and science going on,
mm-hmm.
but that cast iron pot produces a different fry. I'm positive of it. Also, get rid of the water. Do not rinse your potatoes. You know what happens when water hits hot oil. It's a bad thing.
Right.
You know, that's part of the problem with freezing them is you get the condensate on the outside of the potato.
You know, and there's also sort of all kinds of subtle little hits in the book that I think are really great. Like you have a chilled pea soup where the soup comes from the pods and the peas are left whole. And, you know, just being in the restaurant business, I look through your book and I see, like, things that just make a normal common dish just pop like that. And I think it's really great.
These chefs are very frugal. They have low prices. And they... Now some of the bistro chefs are actually very accomplished young chefs who jumped off, you know, they're off the Michelin ladder to success, and they decide to run their own bistro. So they're ambitious, but their food costs have to be low.
Well, if you'd like to learn more about the bistros, brasseries, and wine bars of Paris, you should pick up the book by that title. It's authored by our guest today, Daniel Young. And Daniel, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thanks, Daniel. Super. Thanks so much.
So if you want to pick up that book, you can link to it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. It is a great cookbook to keep around your kitchen. I'm sure it's going to become a dog-eared addition to my collection. The stuff is really simple and fun to do, and it's some classics that you may have heard of and never cooked. And I recommend it pretty highly. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. You know...
So during the break, Francis is sitting here and he's leafing through the book, I swear, and he goes to the poached whole chicken and he goes, "This is so good, I'm going to make this, I swear."
I cannot wait. We were talking in the book, this is not for your diet conscious people, but again, I think good, wholesome whole foods that are a little decadent during meals are great. And just
Do you know why we have a food show?
Why?
Because we love it so much, that's why.
This is that. He got this from, by the way, in the back of this book is a guide to all the different bistros that he got the mm-hmm. recipes from, with mm-hmm. the phone numbers to make reservations from the States and all
and
that stuff.
And also like a little mini review, and I think that was one of the things that I liked about
it. And he was a restaurant reviewer by trade.
He gave you truthfully what he thought. It's not all, I love this place, oh, I love this place, oh, I love this place, oh, I love this place. Some of it is, you know, I like this about this place, and I don't like this about this place.
I just got to give you the over. We don't really do this very often on the show, but I got to tell you about this recipe. It's so simple, like so many of the recipes in this book. And he basically says you take a 5 to 6 pound chicken, and the ingredients are the chicken, bouillon cubes, you know, a real cheap trick, carrots, onions, turnips, a leek, and 2 quarts of cream. You basically take it all together and you put the chicken in a Dutch oven mm-hmm. with the cream.
And you roast it
right above the cream. And then you remove the chicken and vegetables from the casserole. And you put 2 or 3 cups of the sauce through a sieve or a filter or a colander into a saucepan. And then you cook that over medium heat with a whisk until it foams.
To let it shrink.
So you're basically taking the 2 quarts of cream, which have cooked under the chicken.
Which are now filled with chicken fat.
Oh, and then you heat it up, and then you...
It's gonna
and
be
then
delicious.
You whisk it as it foams,
it's
and that's the sauce. That's it. You know it's going to be great.
I'm sensing a lunch sometime this week coming up.
And I might use stock instead of bouillon cubes just because I, well, can...
Because you have stock?
Because I own a restaurant and I can say, can I have some of that stock? But you can buy great frozen stock and or even demi-glaze, and I might throw a little demi-glaze in here.
Some of the specialty food stores that you hear us talk about all the time will carry actual stock as opposed to bouillon, and it's the real ingredient.
So then you cut up the chicken into parts, and then you put the chicken and vegetables on a serving plate and top generously, I bet, two quarts, generously with the cream. I absolutely love it. The bar is called the Bistros, Brasseries, and Wine Bars of Paris. Everyday recipes from the real Paris. The author is Daniel Young, who is our guest today, and I can't recommend it highly enough. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the restaurant guys. We certainly have. We're going to go out and make some cream chicken.
Cream chicken coming today.
Yeah, I'm Francis Schott.
I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the restaurant guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 12 noon.